Let's just start. Yeah. Someone just pops it. Yeah. Drink.
Okay, everybody. I'd like to welcome you here this evening to the LSE London seminar. We have tonight for our speaker, Greg Clark. For those of you who don't know Greg, he's an international advisor on city and metropolitan development. He's the chair of a number of committees, one of which is the OECD Forum for Development Agencies and Investment Strategies, and you were the former chair of Cities and Regions for the OECD as well.
Yep.
And also a senior fellow at the Urban Land Institute, which I know, especially for some of the students, will sound incredibly sexy and good. And our interest in him tonight, beyond the sexy Urban Land Institute thing, is that he's actually going to be talking to us a little bit about a project that he's doing, looking back on the London Planning and Advisory Committees on a Chapman project into London, the world city. So you're going to be looking back at that, which I've been told now is 20 years old, which makes me feel very, very ill indeed to think that was...
Think of how some of the people in the audience feel. They wrote it.
Yeah, absolutely, to think that was 20 years ago. But you will be talking us through that this evening.
I will.
So I will let you go ahead and start.
Well, thank you very much indeed. And lest anyone be disappointed, I better say very quickly, I'm not Greg Clark, the Minister for Cities. Who is obviously in charge of British urban policy at the moment, knows a lot more than I do about where British cities are at. But if you thought you were coming to listen to him, now's the time to depart quickly. Just happen to have the same name. What I want to do, exactly as introduced, is really talk about this book. And what's interesting about this book, apart from the fact that the main authors are actually nearly all in the room, and certainly the man who directed the study is here, and the junior academics Tony Travers and Ian Gordon, who were advisors on the book, are still here and still junior, but obviously senior in other ways. This book that was written 20 years ago, I really want to talk about that, and I want to talk about it as a project that's being undertaken to honour Chapman, and I'll say quite a bit about honour Chapman in a minute or two. But what I wanted to just say first is that this project's being sponsored by five private sector organisations: Jones Lang LaSalle, Land Securities, the Great Portland Estate, Grosvenor, and the London Communications Agency. So these are organisations really in the real estate, property and investment world in London. And the reason they're sponsoring it is because they think, firstly, Honour Chapman should be honoured, and I agree with that, and I'll say why. But also I think they feel that this book marked a kind of watershed in London's development 20 years ago. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's the first time the government published a book. This is Her Majesty's Stationery Office publishing the LPAC report with the words London and World City in the title. In a minute, I'll go on to tell you what Tony said about it when I interviewed him recently. So what I want to do is, assuming I can make this work, firstly we'll have a little bit of a talk about the book itself, the fact that following the publication, the Conservative Manifesto of 1992 was the first manifesto to mention new arrangements for London in the current era. We'll talk a little bit about the recognition of London as a world city and what was implied by that, the idea of a new development path or a new development trajectory, whether you like it or not. We'll talk about the advantages and disadvantages of it later on, I'm sure. And then the calls that were made in this publication. It called for a very active international promotion of London. It called for the need to tackle the infrastructure deficit, to address skills, and particularly the economic exclusion tendency of London's skills deficits and cultural promotion. And what I'm really doing is I'm asking these three questions. How has London fared since 1991? What's actually happened? I've started to accumulate a bit of data about that. Where are we today? And what about the next 10 years? Now, I'll not embarrass people by introducing everybody in the room who had something to do with the study, and there are many. Suffice to say that I haven't finished my work. My proposition is that I'm about 6 weeks to go on a study which is actually about a 16-week study, so there's a long way to go. So this evening I won't be giving you hard and fast outcomes, But I will be asking you to kind of help me a little bit formulate these outcomes, particularly on what about the next 10 years? And I guess the big question in there is, if you continue with the London World City theme, the World City development path, will you get something that you think is successful, or will the tensions just be exacerbated? And what will be required to do that? If you didn't continue with the World City development path, is there an alternative model for London? Is there another way that London could succeed? And of course, that will be very interesting to look at. Well, let's get on and move straight into... that's the report structure I'm going to write. Let me say a little bit about Honor Chapman and why this report is being done in her honour. I think that the key thing to say is that Honor Chapman was a very active person on the London scene for at least 20 years. And in the property investment world of London over that period, there were some very interesting dynamics of change that happened. She was a leading figure, and the only female leading figure, in a generation of property and investment leaders who oversaw the shift from property being seen as essentially an equity that would perform according to the broad dynamics of markets, rather than an asset whose individual performance could be shaped by managerial behaviour and by strategy. And what Honor introduced into the whole conversation was the idea of the customer, the tenant, operating in a dynamic environment, making choices about what they needed according to a wide range of strategic preferences as well as external dynamics. What this meant was that property ceased to be like gold, something you buy and hold, and became much more like a job, a career, or something else, something that you can shape and augment and you can add value to by developing it and presenting it in a certain way. In other words, the dynamics of competitive markets began to play a role in how property was seen, and Honor was one of the generation that introduced new research techniques, new data analysis, and other ways of thinking about and conceiving of property. This hugely updated, as it were, the thinking in the London property market, and this happened just at the same time as international capital began to form large-scale international investment funds for property, and London's initial drive in the late 80s and early 90s to become, as it were, a location for international investment in property was both part of this trend and was also shaped by it. So that's why Honor Chapman is important for people in the property industry. The thing is that in Honor's career, there was also a kind of big second play as well. And the big second play was to take the idea of competitive analysis, this kind of research, this understanding of customer orientation, and not just to apply it to individual buildings or to districts, but to start to apply it to cities overall. So she'd been to she'd been to the London Business School, she'd been a Sloan Fellow, she'd studied Porterian theories of competitiveness, and she'd become very interested in post-Big Bang and post-EU single European market in 1992, the dynamics of competition between cities. And then so firstly, as the person who established and then led the London First Centre, coming out of the recommendations of London World City, then as the chairman of the Cardiff Bay Development Corporation, then as a member of the London Development Agency's board, then as chairman of the London Development Agency, and then the founding chairman of Future London, she took this idea of cities in competition and how you could develop strategies for whole cities, not just for individual pieces of real estate. So that, in a sense, was Honor's contribution. She didn't do it alone. She was part of a generation that was thinking in these ways, but she was seen by many people as a key figure, and certainly the most prominent female who was able to break through into what was a very challenging male world in order to do that. Honor died 2 years ago, and so it's in her honor that the report's being written. Let's move on, in a sense, to look now at what the report said. Martin, I hope it'll spare your blushes if I say the report was widely seen as a game changer. The idea was to decisively raise expectations. So I think, Martin, when you and I spoke, you said it should be a jolt, should sort of change people's thinking about London. There was a sense, 5 years on from the abolition of the GLC, that confusion, disappointment, anger, conflict, of course, which had been right at the heart of the GLC abolition, had not led to a new vision, a sense of self-confidence, a more proactive agenda. And therefore, this was an effort to create that by bringing together a coalition of London boroughs and of business organisations encouraged by central government, with the arts and culture sector and the higher education sector very much involved, to drive forward a new vision for London. And that vision was a vision very much based in the competitive globalisation theory, awareness of 1992 coming, concern about the rampant competitiveness that was being forged in the smithy of some of the other European cities, and therefore a lot of concern. So this was a vision of London as the world's leading city, focused very much on wealth creation, jobs and incomes, and quality of life. Some of these ideas will sound very contemporary when you sort of start to listen to them. The idea was to create a coherent and credible voice for metropolitan governance, but as both Martin and Tony explained to me, not a proposition to recreate citywide government, because of course it was only 5 years since the abolition of the GLC, and everybody knew that it would be politically unfeasible to come forward with a report that recommended that. In a sense, the rest would be ignored if that's what you said. The idea of promoting London actively, you know, for many people in the British establishment at the time, and I personally remember John Major saying that to attempt to promote London would be to compromise the dignity of the capital, which, you know, was a very odd kind of idea, that if you actively promoted something, you must think there's something wrong with it. Very British idea. You don't sell unless, you know, you've got dumb goods. So there had been a desire for a sea change, the recognition that other cities were promoting themselves actively, therefore London should do the same. And interestingly, a strong focus that I think was quite unique at the time on London's cultural and artistic assets, this idea that amenity, quality of life, quality of cultural life, there was somehow that insight that's a very common insight today, that there's a relationship between quality of life, the attraction and retention of talent in a city, and the relationship of that talent to building strategic clusters and everything else. So that was new. What did some people say about it? Well, Tony, you said to me, the London World City Report was the beginning of modern history in London, which I thought was a very interesting quote, and I've heard nothing that contradicts that. Robert Gordon Clark at the London Communications Agency, after the 1991 report, a generation of business leaders stood up together to build an agenda for London and make the case for London. A new kind of business leadership was created. There's something in that. Howard Dorber at Canary Wharf. Following the London World City Report, London started to promote itself actively, with business leadership taking up the challenge. In 2000, the mayor took up the mantle. This has enabled London to develop its own story, distinct from the UK. We'll come back to that. In the international arena, London is now a more self-confident city. In other words, what the report achieved was a combination of central government beginning to take London more seriously, but also the business community, sometimes in collaboration with the boroughs, although, Martin, I think when we come to the discussion, you'll tell us how strong that collaboration was, sometimes in collaboration with the boroughs, deciding they must promote London, and that's where Honor Chapman entered the story and helped them to create the London First Centre. If we look at what happened since then, Martin Crookson will remember this slide in particular, because this appears in the London World City Study. Nick Banks is the author of it, is he?
Yeah, I did that one. Yeah.
You did that one. Thank you, Nick.
His books.
Right, his book, your picture. So what is interesting in the London World City Study, this image only appears 4 years later in the Four World Cities Study, but what's interesting is the beginning of the conversation about the self-reinforcing nature of what you might call, if you like that language, cluster development, or essentially how agglomeration economics works in an international city, whereby these things reinforce each other. How long since you've seen this picture, Nick?
15 years.
Okay. It's widely appreciated around the world, I can tell you. We'll come back to that. Now, if you look back at the study, you could say that some challenges have been solved, but others really persist. Firstly, on the old rivals, new rivals. In this study, there's, you know, it's a lot of concern with Berlin, Frankfurt and Brussels as competitors to London. I don't think we're too worried about Berlin, Frankfurt and Brussels at the moment. On the other hand, there's no observation about Hong Kong, which has clearly rapidly, on most measures, become a very important city, and certainly no mention of these other emerging world cities. The transport focus in this study is very much about fixing metropolitan transport. It's a big concern about public transport and congestion. And what you could say is that some of the institutional inertia has been overcome. There have been some big projects, more or less one or two big projects every decade for the last two decades. But there's still a big challenge around upgrades, and I'm sure we're going to come back to talking about investment in infrastructure later. Some concerns have never gone away. The book raises the concern that London's economy is too dominated by finance and business services, and it may be unbalanced, to use a modern phrase, and that this may be bad, both in terms of crowding out other activity, but also in terms of, as it were, simply having too many eggs in one basket. And then there's a warning of a burgeoning of those sections of the population who exist outside the social and economic life of the community, the so-called underclass. It's probably your words, Ian, is it? But you know, a big concern about that 21 years ago. On the other hand, there's almost zero mention of climate change in this report. There's not much concern about that. A little bit about air quality and the unbreathability. And on the other hand, there are sections in the report that, as it were, extol the virtues of London's advantageous housing market, where there is plentiful supply at affordable prices for people who want to come and live in London. So obviously, you know, things have moved on a bit since then. The corollary of that, of course, is that the report is rather concerned with corporate real estate, the non-availability of enough real estate for the leading global industries that London needs to attract. But of course, that story has gone rather better than the housing story in the last period of time. Moving on. Okay, a few more quotes. So this is now looking back from here. In 2012, the issue is no longer the challenge from EU-based cities as it was in 1991. It's all about competition from the other great global cities. That's John Dickey from London First. Here's Colin Stanbridge from the London Chamber of Commerce. London has been a great place to live, as well as to work, invest and be in business. Keeping it a great place to live is key for the future success. London symbolises aspiration and opportunity and a way of life. It provides the depth of choices that many people want. I think a good summary of what many people say has happened to London during that 21 years. And then London's developed a much greater sense of self-confidence in the past 20 years. It was once drab, gritty, with a sense of decline and a lack of aspiration. Now there's a huge contrast. It's vibrant, lively, full of new spirit of possibility. That's Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institution. So widely, people see that things have moved on since then. We'll say a bit more about what the content of that is right away, and then we'll get on to talking about what comes next. So London economy... I think most of this story is familiar, and there may be people in the room who want to add to the analysis or even subtract from it, but essentially London's overall GDP and business growth has exceeded all of the major rivals in Europe over that 20-year period, give or take some dips here and there. We'll look at the dips in a minute. Finance and business services have been the big driver of economic growth and have been one of the drivers of population growth. Of course, there have been changes in the institutional and regulatory framework that have made a big difference there. The unique openness, both historically and more recently, to national and international populations in London has played a very key part in population growth in the city. And then there's been this paradox of the persistence of high unemployment and deprivation alongside wealth creation and success, which again we'll come on to talk about. There's the curve of London's growth over that period. This is sourced from GLA Economics, as you can see. And you can see, apart from the dip in the early 2000s, it's been pretty well, and of course what's happened in the recent period, pretty well a strong phase of growth. Jerry Blundell said 20 years ago there was no vision for London. Deregulation opened the space for competition. Cosmopolitanism and the Big Bang meant that London became very attractive for overseas talent. It was a place where you could be yourself. Unlike Paris or New York, where it said you have to become a Parisian or a New Yorker to be there. London's special feature is its leadership in the EU time zones. In the 1990s, London opened up to global business and talent. London's success with the second financial centre at Canary Wharf inspires other cities who want to do the same. But few have succeeded. So what in 1991, Eric, was a something of a cause for concern, even though there was great excitement about the investment, if you remember where Canary Wharf was in 1991, widely seen, at least by these commentators, as a global success. And then colleagues from Paris saying Paris is a very cosmopolitan city, but the identity is French, with a focus on integration. London is much more about pluralism. So this openness to international talent, this willingness to become a cosmopolitan city, this, as it were, synthesizing together of British tradition of trade and openness with a more cosmopolitan society led to a huge increase in skills and in productivity. That seems to explain large pieces of this. This is the percentage growth in finance and business services, 92 to 2008, comparing London's growth versus the other cities, and you can simply see that London, as it were, had a bigger growth curve during both periods.
Sorry, Greg, was that jobs or GDP or what?
Left-hand side is GDP, right-hand side is jobs. And then GVA share of finance and business services, percentage of Europe, US and Japan total. You can see London's percentage in financial services rising considerably from 95 through to 2010. Business services rising, though not so much. And then, of course, this is the Cushman & Wakefield European Cities Monitor. Familiarity with London, really looking at business perceptions of London. London seen as the top city in Europe, maintaining its advantage above Paris and Barcelona here, that has come very much up over that period. I'll show you a different version of that in a minute. And then the internationalisation of London's population that we've been talking about quite a bit. By the way, I'm looking for the data that enables me to contrast this 2009 data with 1999 and 1989. If anybody knows where I can get that data, it'd be tremendously helpful. But what I think you can see that probably many people in this room know is this incredible internationalisation of London's population and all the many and different sources, including people who've come, of course, from within the EU, people who've come from new states, people who've come from old Commonwealth countries, people who've come from many other places. This internationalisation of London's population is a major feature. And interestingly, London's share of international migrants to the UK kind of hits a peak up here in about sort of 1999-2000, and then tails off. And again, I'd be interested in explanations of this, but part of what I think is happening here is simply London being an entry point that creates familiarity with the UK, so that people begin by immigrating to London, and afterwards, of course, they can go to lots of other parts of the city. London's position in a very wide range of benchmarking studies, rankings, indexes, whatever else you want to call them, shows you, I think, in comparison to the basket of other European leading cities, that it's really achieved the aims of the London World City Report to become the leading world city in Europe, bar none. If you like these kinds of studies, and I know some people don't, obviously some of them are much better than others in all sorts of ways. Now, turning to London's governance during the same period, what you might say from 91 to 2000 was that there were various attempts and efforts at collaborative governance to fill the vacuum of strategic policy making. I'll show you a long chart of all of these in a minute. Suffice to say, the point was made earlier on that business played a role, central government also played a role, the boroughs played a role, and there were various arrangements. The London Forum was a business-led organisation that was already in discussions with the Conservative government just before the 92 election, and after the 92 election, London First was established from that group as a leading business leadership group in London. It'll be an interesting part of the conversation as to whether the creation of London First also enabled the other business organisations to play their role well or not. Strategic initiatives based on pragmatic and partnership-based platforms, the London Pride Partnership, the London Pride Prospectus, I'll show you that again in a minute, and perhaps, depending on your view, the City of London very much re-established during this period as a valued and trusted partner in London governance arrangements, leading on to the big deal done with Tony Blair in 97 following Labour's election. Again, we'll come back to that. From 2000 onwards, the mayor as ambassador, perhaps, being a good way to put it. GLA boosted London's spatial planning powers with the London Plan. The mayor seeks to, derives economic and transport strategies with operational impetus, but very limited resources, weak powers in housing, education and infrastructure. This will be a big point at the end. And governance remains complex. Central government wields the most power. Interestingly, you'll see a few more comments from Tokyo and Hong Kong and New York from the interviews I've done there. Everybody outside the UK thinks it's impossible to run a world city with a city government that's got such limited powers, and yet everybody within the UK is kind of trying to find the way to make it work. That's quite interesting. Here's many of the interesting studies. Again, people in the room have been either leaders of these or very much involved with them, so I won't pretend to know all of them better than anyone else. A series of studies here, the creation of the GLA, a series of strategic plans, if you like. All of these documents in one way or another seem to me to be part of the same development path of London as a world city, albeit with different inflections on how inclusive that world city would be, or how sustainable that world city might be, or how much it might accommodate. You laughing, Martin, because you can see all your work.
No, I'm just remembering with horror the London study in 1999.
Ah, yes.
Meetings with a remarkable man.
Yes. I mean, actually, this was one of the funniest studies I seem to remember. The key thing I think about all of this is that there's a development path that is consistently reinforced through all of this, which is a world city kind of development path, this idea of competing globally and therefore needing to invest in order to be competitive, both in terms of infrastructure, in terms of skills, in terms of promotion, and everything else that was established in the first study. At the same time, here we are with the winning manifestos of the general elections over the period since London World City was founded. This is the Conservative Manifesto of 1992. London's a magnet to visitors and business from across the world. We will convene a new private sector forum, that's London Forum, that becomes London First, to promote London internationally as a business, tourist and cultural centre, and we will support the vigorous cultural life of the capital. The cultural life, once again, being seen very important. 5 years later, here's the Tony Blair Labour Party manifesto. London's the only Western capital without an elected city government. There'll be a new deal for London with a strategic authority and a mayor, each directly elected. So that's the big sort of moment of change. And then in 2001, you can see the slight turn in sort of change of voice here. This is the Labour manifesto again. London will benefit from new trains and reduced overcrowding on its commuter services. That's the PPP, Tony, I think, is it not? In 2001. Mm-hmm. Yeah? We will build a new east-west crossrail tunnel and extend the East London line. Yeah? So promises, promises. And then 2005, we'll invest in extra housing in London and the wider southeast, with particular emphasis on the Thames Gateway, now deceased, at least for the moment, as some of you know. And then this is the Conservative Manifesto of 2010. We'll abolish the Government Office for London as part of a plan to devolve more power downwards to the London boroughs and the Mayor of London. So what you see in a way here, if you just took this as a kind of a stylized sketch, you see central government saying, actually, we're going to take London seriously for the first time. And this involved creating a lot of central government apparatus to engage with London. And then you see the same party, 18 years later, abolishing that apparatus because the other apparatus that's been set up, which is more regionally and locally accountable, is perceived to be now the apparatus to devolve power to. I think a very interesting kind of cyclical story there. Here's a whole series of initiatives, joint committees, partnership forums, other groups that were created in one way or another over the period. I don't think we'll go through all of them in the interest of time, and as I say, many people in the room know them well. But suffice to say, in that period up to 2000, a lot of public-private initiative. In that period from 2000, a lot of GLA gradually acquiring more powers and responsibilities in one way or another coming in there. What do they say about London's governance? Here's Peter Hall. The London mayor has proved to be brilliantly effective in three ways. Promoting London internationally, coordination of activities within London, and making the case for London to central government. International promotion, internal coordination, making the case for London to central government. That's Peter's view. Here's Susan Feinstein, some of you know. Compared to New York City, I won't do the accent because that will really make you laugh. London's major problem is inadequate investment in infrastructure such as trains. New York has also pulled ahead on livability and city management and support for entrepreneurs and for small businesses. So again, the international view of London, less rosy about the progress that we've made. The next section looks at London's urban development. I don't intend to do this in great detail, partly because there is a lot of detail there, but suffice to say, those of you who remember the period know that the big turning point was the decision, in a sense, not to do anything substantially to arrest industrial decline, and therefore, instead, to begin a process. This is a kind of stylized clock that I created, 1950s up there, 2000s around here, looks at the phases of urban redevelopment in London. Suffice to say, the point is that when you get round to the 70s and then the 80s, globalization is beginning to kick in, Big Bang is coming, single European market is upon us, and the choice that the government made, as it were, not to deliberately try to arrest decline, but instead to try to recycle former industrial land, then becomes a big driver for all sorts of urban development projects that you can see here, like Docklands, the Millennium and the Olympic Games. Again, I'm just rushing to save a bit of time. I like to think of this in five phases. Here's the various bits of South Bank Phase 1. And then here we've just gone through Docklands Phase 1 and then the Millennium and the completion of the South Bank. Then that's there as well, Millennium activities. Then you've got this kind of current phase of the Olympics and the Golden Triangle in East London. And then you've got this idea of a Thames Gateway or a corridor or something else coming out thereafter. All of these things, in a way, reinforcing the same idea that we can redevelop, reuse, recycle industrial land or really logistics land and use it for other purposes and done extremely well. I think in London's urban development there are also some very interesting themes that you can look at over the period. If you look back in reflection, there's the redevelopment of markets, in a sense beginning with Covent Garden and then moving on from there. And of course now with Nine Elms and everything else that's happening, that's running its course. There's the relationship between the redevelopment of stations and the expansion of central London beyond its normal central London borders into a wider zone. And in a sense, whether you're looking at London Bridge today or King's Cross yesterday or Paddington the day before, all of these station redevelopments represent another piece of central London moving out. There's the sports-led regeneration story, which of course today is about the Olympics, but has also been about the Emirates Stadium in North London, Wembley Stadium, which of course is an ongoing process. There's a big shopping and retail element to the redevelopment process, and then there's also the redevelopment impact of lots of transport projects. It's not a story we can tell very quickly, so I'm going to leave most of it there. Now, in the next bit of the study, what we want to look at is World City performance in 2012, and in a sense to say what's the context for London's growth for the next 10 years. A key part of this is really looking at the main developments. Depending on the data that you want to look at and the studies and the methodologies you prefer, you might say, as I like to say, that we've gone from having the big four that were identified in 1991 of London, Paris, New York and Tokyo, really to having a big six with a kind of big 12 not far behind them. It's a bit like the way the Premier League has gone, if you're a football fan. There used to be only four clubs that would qualify for Europe. Now there's six, eight or 10 that possibly could. The world city system has gone somewhere similar. Singapore and Hong Kong very much joining in. Shanghai, Beijing and Seoul now genuinely competitive places, certainly for a wider range of industries. Other Asian powerhouses actually struggling. I think 20 years ago we thought Mumbai was a faster prospect than it's proved to be. Jakarta and Bangkok obviously having big problems. I think substantial divergence in Europe. Cities we didn't expect to see in the league, like Barcelona, Stockholm and Zurich, to take three. Very much top 10 cities in Europe, whatever you think about that. 20 years ago they weren't seen as that, and Barcelona's growth and Zurich's growth are real surprises, I think, from 20 years ago. On the other hand, Rome and Milan have declined, Amsterdam and Vienna have stayed stable and not really moved anywhere and are uncertain about where they're going, so there's a real changing dynamics there. North American cities, when you look at them vis-a-vis the other global cities, have all, relatively speaking, started to shift down in the various measures and benchmarks, partly simply because other cities are growing. But if you twist and you look at human capital dimensions, North American cities, with their historical advantage of being extremely open to immigration, continue to perform very well. There's lots of data to show Chicago and Toronto, for example, behind New York, still doing well on attracting international talent. Sao Paulo, Latin America's most prominent business hub, moving ahead of Mexico City, the BRICS effect working very much for Sao Paulo, much more than it is for Mexico City. Why am I telling you all of this? Because I think the dynamics of competition and innovation and collaboration between the world's major cities is changing. And I think it's changing because there's much more of an emphasis on the role of cities in R&D and science, applied technology innovation, much more of a focus on what they can do to innovate around sustainability and climate change. Human diversity and the quality of life in cosmopolitan cities becoming more important and becoming a strong driver of science and cultural amenities and trade sectors, and the whole emergence of smart cities. In other words, whereas in 1991-92 we thought that the dynamics of competition were mainly in the area of financial services, corporate HQs, command and control decision-making functions, I think we would now admit that there's a broader canvas for cities to play on and the potential to be seen as leaders in other sectors and to do well by doing that. This is simply a summary of what I call the top 12 cities and the top 5 benchmarking studies. And you can see this is not really science. This is sort of inspired guesswork. So don't take this as literal. But if you ascribe sort of nominal weightings to everything, what you see is basically New York continuing to do well, London doing very well as well, although some question marks emerging about London, and I'll tell you more about those shortly. And then you see the dynamics of change, where essentially the Singapores, the San Franciscos, the Sydneys coming up. You can see Hong Kong in there. Los Angeles actually remaining relatively strong, but principally because of its leadership in one industry. London's potential for success seems to be based on some things we know quite well. Continuing financial services and all of the advantages that come from London's inheritance, but also plans for it to become an even more international financial centre. High export-focused, flexible economy, in the enduring strengths in some of these new industries. Few risks, and this has been particularly important in attracting private wealth, as it were, to London. It's still seen as a very safe and secure place for the wealthy. Proven capacity to achieve productivity gains through sound management and through the use of good skills. The higher education provision, which I'll talk a bit more about in a minute. The history of openness, a decade-old business culture and brand awareness. In other words, when you look at the new dynamics of world city competition, collaboration, innovation, you can see London having a good play in all of that, so there's no reason for despair. And if you look at the projections, this is McKinsey's numbers on GDP forecasts, you see London still doing well, sort of matching Shanghai by the time we get to 2025, and you'll see it's still on PwC's map, despite the fact that, you know, Madrid disappears off it and Istanbul arrives in it, but London is still very much there. So what are the challenges and opportunities for the next 10 years? I want to come on to that, but I think what I'll do is just jump ahead, because some of this stuff is going to look a little bit repetitious. And I just want to draw your attention to a series of slides very quickly. PricewaterhouseCoopers and the Partnership for New York City every year sit down. The Partnership for New York City is like it's a part of the Chamber of Commerce. But they sit down every year and they say, where is New York going? And they try to ask a set of reasonably sober questions about New York's standing vis-a-vis the other world cities. And so it involves them in getting all of the PricewaterhouseCoopers offices around the world engaged in both a data collection exercise and a kind of collaborative analysis and weighting process. And they produce something called the Cities of Opportunity Study. People familiar with this? It gets a lot of attention in New York, not much in London, because New York always comes out number one. So it won't surprise you. But when they look at economic clout, they're very clear that, you know, London remains, as far as they're concerned, you know, very attractive city, doing extremely well. This is the 2011 score. So you would have thought, seeing this, that London was going to perform well in the study overall. Then they come to what they call lifestyle assets, which is about culture and amenity and everything else. And London, in their opinion, drops. I mean, the good thing about this study is it's not written by London about London. So you get to see a slightly different perspective. When it comes to ease of doing business, this is tax, regulations, business climate, how easy it is to do business. London drops down to fourth in this group of cities. And then when you come on to transport and infrastructure, this includes airports, rail, tube, roads, you see London again coming down a little bit. Now it's into sixth place here. When you come on to sustainability, you look at energy efficiency in London, the broader livability agenda around, you know, everything from food and energy, carbon emissions, public health aspects of this, London has dropped even further. Then you come on to looking at intellectual capital innovation. My own feeling is, as ever, this is skewed towards scientific innovation. And of course, London's innovation is not only scientific, but you see London again dropping down. You come on to costs. This includes, of course, tax, rents and housing costs. And London's come a bit further down there. And then you come on to demographics and livability, where housing availability, crime, feelings of safety, other things are involved. I don't show you these slides, as it were, simply to say this is what they're saying in New York. But I think there's something interesting here in that the world is onto or has a view about London's strengths and London's weaknesses in 2012. And what they basically say is that if London wants to pursue this model of being a world city with this economic clout, this business community and everything else, it's got to find ways to deal with some of the other issues that arise. In other words, their feeling is that the last 20 years, apart from substantial investment in transport infrastructure, the last 20 years has seen a lot of delay of dealing with pressing public issues that affect London that need to be tackled if London's going to be able to turn this into the sustainable world city. Or I think that was Ken was the sustainable world city, and Boris's objective is to make it the most livable big city in the world. Well, either of those objectives have some distance to go if they're going to succeed. So this is now coming into summary territory and getting ready for the discussion with you. What's London's success since 1991 been based on? How has London succeeded? Well, what people have said to me is that, of course, there's been this amazing historical endowment. We know about time zone, not just the advantage of being in the EU to be part of the EU, but the ability to trade between the EU and to look east to Asia and west to America, and the idea of London as a bridge into the EU and London as a gateway out of the EU to other markets. That's worked well for us. English language, English law, British professional standards in accountancy and everything else, all of those things have worked in London's favour. As it were, the capital of the English-speaking business world, if you want to put it that way. That's all been very good. Openness and diversity. London's deep history of openness and tolerance and willingness to embrace people from other parts of the world has been very important. That's enabled business to be open. Relatively speaking, our institutions are open. Our media is open. You can come to London, move to London, live in London, as long as you can get a visa, of course. And you know, you can participate in society at all levels of the income spectrum. I don't want to over-romanticise this. The identity, the reputation and the brand is very clear. Actually, what surprised me in the 70 or so interviews I've done is how much people outside the UK talked about they love London because they really like the way the British do things. I find it hard to identify what's the way the British do things in London, but in a British sense, but they very much see that very clearly. The identity and reputation, diversity, opportunity, creativity, entrepreneurship, all of those things. The talent and the business space, whether it's been the role of companies in simply attracting talent or whether it's been changes in macroeconomic framework, the benefits, the agglomeration benefits, as it were, of having the business space and the talent base working together have been good. There has been some leadership. We've talked a little bit about that. There's also been the new governance arrangements that I've described, which you know, Tony and others are more expert on. And there's been periods of governmental support that have been very effective. Many people commented on London's universities being a key element in success over the last 20 years. A means not just to bring people into the city and then integrate them into the labour market, but also a means to sell London's reputation and to give people a sense of this city somehow being part of their careers. Connectivity has improved a lot with the big transport projects that have happened, but as you'll hear in a moment, huge concern about airports. Culture, place and street life. Many people have commented to me that one of the great things about London has been that it has very active street life, which is supported by a sense of place, by design, by public spaces and everything else, and that this creates, as it were, a rich cosmopolitanism. People don't just pass each other by, they actually have places where they can engage. The capacity for reinvention has been evidenced very much in the urban redevelopment, urban regeneration activity. And then, broadly speaking, there have been phases of sequenced, synchronised government alignment where the London government or the boroughs and the central government or the London business and the central government have really agreed about something, and they've been able to use the power of the British state, as it were, to make something happen. So there've been periods where that's worked. Now, what about the challenges for the next 10 years? What, again, people have said to me during the course of preparing the book is, firstly, the repositioning of London in the global scene is not actually an easy thing to do. The damage to the reputation of both financial services and London caused by the crisis on the one hand, misconceptions about London's economy and London's society on the other hand. For example, if you ask I ask the taxi driver question when I'm talking to people, what percentage of London's economy is financial services? Nearly everyone you talk to from outside the UK says, well, it's at least 50%. Right? At least 50%. So there is a perception problem about what London is. And if you ask the question, well, how can we make more of our applied sciences and our medicine and our media and our information services and our higher education and all of these other high-value activities that London has? Well, one of the things is they have to become much more visible. Not visible at the moment. So repositioning London in respect to the new global competition, the new global dynamics, is actually quite tricky. And I think it involves telling the story in different ways. The second thing is infrastructure and airports. Nobody would be surprised to hear that airports is the topic that has been most raised in all of the conversations I've had. If I tell you roughly, if I took a straw poll of the 70 people I've interviewed, 70% of them want to go down to the Thames estuary and build a new airport with 6 runways and 8 terminals and get on with it now. 30% of them think this is utter madness. And anyone who proposes that should be, you know, certified very quickly and sent off for remedial treatment. There's a very interesting polarisation of views about how you deal with this. What everybody says, though, is the problem with London is it takes so bloody long to do anything. Now, the complaints about the 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 40 years in the case of Crossrail, to go from the idea first being put to actually being implemented. In the global environment in which London's now working, if you're pursuing the world city paradigm, that doesn't work. There are big threats to openness, tax and regulation. For a city that whose part of its DNA is about openness to international talent, the new national immigration policy is completely in tension with London's world city proposition. Those two ideas of restricting immigration in those ways and London emerging as an international centre, particularly for the emerging markets, particularly for those outside the EU, those two ideas do not work. So there has to be some give there. There is a complete lack of alignment between the framework conditions and what the regional strategy is. On tax, of course, 50% is the big worry. How many other world cities get away with 50% taxation? So, and then of course Tobin is a big concern. We've talked a little bit about whether the London economy needs to be rebalanced. As I've said already, I think there's an issue in here about both perception and reality in terms of having a more diversified economy, but that probably starts with having a perception of an economy that's more diversified and building that. The second most prominent issue, of course, is housing. Almost everyone who I've spoken to has said, you know, the big problem here is that all housing in London is becoming more and more unaffordable. Many people are concerned about the luxury end of the market, where the absentee owners of the billionaire houses actually are eroding the quality of life in the richer neighbourhoods. But there's also a big concern generally about the affordability of housing, and I think you won't be surprised to hear that most of the recommendations involve some combination of, firstly, increasing private rented housing, and doing that principally by getting institutional investors interested again. That means doing away with the legacy of the rent control acts that were the thing that pushed institutional investors out of the market in the 1970s. Some application of public land to the process to make construction more feasible and affordable. Some improvements to the planning process to make development more certain and more speedy. And most people argue continued reform that equates to some kind of rationing of public housing so that you create more of a ladder between all of this. So in other words, at the moment, most people say it's actually boosting the private rented sector. Those who've thought about it for a long time say, actually, you've got to do all of that, but you've also got to have some very serious conversations with groups of home builders about trying to change their appetite and maybe even providing them with various kinds of guarantees and incentives to make it work. Skills and education. There's on the one hand the productivity challenge of people at the bottom end who are excluded from the labour market. On the other hand, a big set of challenges about retaining the skilled people that London has already attracted. I won't go into what I think is the complex, wicked issue of how do the low-skilled unemployed in London get access to the labour market. As I say, there's people in the room here who've written about this a great deal. And I think there are very big challenges there because it's a wicked issue where so many different parts of the system have separate, as it were, points of leadership, whether it's the issue of the benefit system or the issue of the demand side of the labour market and how employers behave, or it's the issue of the supply side and what is employability, the individual characteristics versus what the educational institutions are able to do. Big problem. Security and livability, huge problems with costs and housing, and London actually developing a reputation now for being a more violent city than people had understood it to be. No surprises there, but when you couple that with the fact that cities like New York are developing the reputation for being relatively safe for their size, you can see it becomes a comparative disadvantage. Maintaining the UK support for London's global roles. When I interviewed Peter Hall, we haven't put it on the slide, but he said, you know, the problem is now that in the rest of the country, London is widely perceived to be pursuing an agenda which has no interest in the welfare of the UK as a whole. A perception that London is pursuing its own path, that, you know, London would like to be Singapore or would like to be Hong Kong almost, and that there's a perception, therefore, that the sustainability, as it were, of the national government's support for London is going to be continuously under question because of the impossible political calculus that creates between where MPs are elected and what they think is economically right for the country. So that issue is going on. At the same time, of course, that's not completely separate from the conversation about how much self-government and fiscal and financial power London has itself. Those two things go hand in hand. So this, I think, is a sort of a political issue for the next 10 years that will either be very happily resolved because London will demonstrate its value to the whole country and people will believe it, or we'll end up with a very clear economic story about the benefits of London, but a difficulty in making that stick in political arguments and conversations. City government powers and the regional scale, well, it won't surprise you, given what I've said has been mentioned by many of the international commentators, that most of the international commentators still think the London arrangements are fiscally and financially extremely weak. And therefore, what it means is that London remains dependent upon central government willingness to take investment, or London's ability to pull off arguments or mechanisms, perhaps like an Olympic Games, or arguments perhaps like here's an interesting way to finance Crossrail. London increasingly having to be inventive in winning money from central government, which of course you may say the effect then of London's fiscal and financial disempowerment is to engage it in behaviour that is not quite the behaviour that a normal self-governing city would do. And then the last thing is making the most of East London, both people and places. This, again, I don't think this will surprise you, but almost everybody talks about the exciting opportunity that is in East London. But nobody can say what the vision for East London is, or what the plan for East London is, or what's going to happen in the next 5 years or the next 10 years. There isn't really a sense of what the guiding principles are there. Last slide. There's about 15 other cities who, albeit on different development paths and with different governance arrangements, have in one way or another been trying to tackle some version of the problems that London has, and have in one way or another had some success. Now, that doesn't mean here's the solutions for London, but it does mean the idea that you could be a world city, follow that development path, and also solve some of those problems is not necessarily impossible. And therefore, whether it's building your own airport in the water, as they did in Hong Kong, or it's having a school system that integrates immigrants well, or it's really diversifying your economy, as they've done in New York, or it's having, you know, a clear kind of talent attraction and global openness strategy as they have in Singapore. There are lots of different examples of how things that are like the problems that London has have been achieved elsewhere. Well, I suppose by way of conclusion then, I think the authors of the London World City Study, and many of them are here in the room, there was a coalition of boroughs and businesses and brains of one way or another. They sort of set out to foster a development path for London that was about becoming a world city. Well, 20 years after the report was written, they clearly succeeded in creating an agenda that was about building a world city. But they clearly also would have looked back today at the situation here and said there are persistent problems with this world city model that we haven't been able to solve. They're now appearing in housing and skills, they appear elsewhere. But there's clearly, you know, another agenda for the next 10 years or the next 20 years. If London's going to continue to pursue the world city path, things that have to be addressed that we don't currently have the right apparatus to address. So I feel probably what we're going to have is another period of institutional innovation in order to get there. So thank you very much. That's the progress so far.
Because we've got to run until 6 o'clock for some questions, and thank you very much for a very, very, very interesting talk. I think you have identified also some fascinating issues where we've got some tensions between the London kind of world city image and some kind of recent government policies, I think, both in the area of immigration, as you've highlighted, but also potentially in the area of education, with the government restructuring higher education, which may make our offer look less world class as time moves on. So there's some kind of fascinating things that may outplay.
And maybe tax and infrastructure finance as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. So we've got time for some questions. And could you also speak up and say your name, as it were?
Martin Simmons, ex chief officer of LPAC, and as you say,
the director of the study.
Originator of the study, together with my late colleague Robin Clement. I'd just like to bring it back as an initial contribution to the role of Honor Chapman.
Yeah.
One thing that Honor did, arising from the World City Study, was to chair something that we set up in LPAC called the London Office Property Review. Now, you'll recall, one of your slides showed it, that the World City Study was undertaken in a period of recession.
Yeah.
The early 1990s, and that particularly hit the London property industry hard.
Yeah.
There was a large overhang of unwanted office space at the time. And one thing we did then at LPAC was to commission an annual office property review supported by the City of London Corporation. And we engaged one of Honor's research acolytes, the late Jeff Marsh, to undertake this with his company, London Property Research. Now, we asked Honor, in fact, then of course Jones now wouldn't, if she would gather together a group of property industry experts that we called the London Office Review Panel, from both the construction property industry and from some of the leading property agents in London, to consider Jeff Marsh's annual report. And Honor did that, starting in 1993, it was the first one. We undertook it annually through the West of LPAC's life. The process was then taken into the GLA, with Honor continuing to lead this review group. Now, what that did was to ensure that we had a proper analysis of both the supply and demand for office space in London, as a major contributor and requirement, of course, for London's World City continuing success.
Yeah.
Both in being, and of course, what happened in Canary Wharf was very much part of that on the supply side. But that process that Honor, in fact, played a major role in, I think, should not go unacknowledged.
Yes. I couldn't agree with you more, Martin. I didn't talk about it in detail today, but I can assure you it's in the report. So thank you very much. What I suppose is interesting, just to take your comment a little bit further, is that, in fact, I have interviewed, as you can imagine, a large number of the major property companies in London as part of this study, and you know that they have very particular views about what's a successful city and everything else. But they seem to be saying that actually the process of discussing and agreeing you know, what office space is needed has become a kind of an implicit part of the debates that go on, both with the GLA in an ad hoc way, but also amongst the industry. But they make the observation that no such similar conversations exist in the residential market. So if you like, there is more fragmentation or less coordination between the builders of residential real estate and the builders of corporate real estate. And I find that believable, but maybe it contributes to the problem that we have.
We've got Ian and then...
Let's Nicholas first.
Oh, sorry, didn't see you first.
Greg, you asked what to do next.
Yes, thank you,
Nick. Looking back over the last 20 years, it seems to me that there was a terrific blast of new understanding in the 1990s about how the London economy works and what it's susceptible to, which is the crucial issue.
Yeah.
But we've rather run out of steam and lost our way in the last 10 years, and the policy initiatives now are the similar types of to the policy initiatives 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And the fundamental problem of the fundamental data problem is the same then as it same now as it was then.
Mm.
Because although we've got slightly bigger survey samples and a few more questions, and the maths and analysis got a lot more complicated, which hardly ever helps, and we've got very, very much better mapping. It's essentially the existing data and information that people mined so successfully in the 1990s. When Bridget was here a couple of weeks ago talking about banking, her most depressing remark was in an aside when she said about research, anyway, I haven't got any budget. The crucial thing, it seems to me, is that we need some new survey work to disaggregate what the geography of national and international activities as compared with regional local activities. It's not much use knowing where the FBS jobs are. We want to know what are the export ones and what are the national ones.
Yeah.
And do they happen in the city, or are they being spread out? There's an awful lot of consultancies in the city-type consultancies in Square Mile that export a lot of their city-type work into their regional offices.
Yeah.
Nobody knows anything about that.
Right.
Somebody really needs to, with a large bag of money, to go and do a serious bit of work on this. And I suspect that will lead to another new raft of policy initiatives, which are quite different from what's on the table now.
That's a very helpful comment, Nick. I may ask you outside this conversation to amplify that. It strikes me that what you're saying, though, is that a lot of the data that would be interesting to be able to look at is in the private sector.
Yes, it is.
So it may be that this is an area where some private sector initiative will also help, which given the austerity agenda under which we live, may be more feasible.
Because what the big thing that those studies, several studies in the 90s did, was they collected data from sources that the public sector and local government had never looked at before, which were available in the private sector and in areas which hadn't actually been used by the public sector.
Now, there's a marked difference, isn't there, that between 1990 and 2000, a lot of creative energy went into constructing intelligence, whereas between 2000 and 2010, the impetus was always for the GLA machinery to focus on getting out the plan or getting out the strategy, less time for deliberation in a certain way. Whatever you think about that, there's some interesting cultural differences between the two decades.
Okay, we have Ian and then Tony.
I guess I'm a disbeliever at most of what you said.
Ian.
I think one of the starting points here is that the London World City Study had almost no research, and had almost no budget for research.
Yeah.
So it's the beginning of a discourse which had some impact,
yeah.
But it's not in itself a research document. You know, and there were good research studies in the decade before World Cities, it's one of them.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting that it has this reputation of having revealed it, because it's almost entirely collecting opinion. And actually, I doubt that any of the authors of the study are in this room, because it was PricewaterhouseCooper who essentially did it. So it was not done from an academic or family consultant's perspective. But I think it's important to understand that, because it couldn't actually get funding to do anything more substantial at the time. The city wouldn't put any serious money. So that's one sort of thing. Nick's point about data is interesting, because I don't think the issue actually is data. You know, if you're interested in international transactions of firms, then there started to be some data coming out of the London Employer Survey, and then the London Business Survey continued by the GLA.
Yeah.
The point is that either nobody used it, no use of it was made by the GLA analysing this data, or when it was used by outsiders, there was no attention to what it showed. And you know, one of the studies that you have up there, which horrified Martin, but the London study in the of the EU-sponsored thing,
yeah.
Which Michael, Martin, and I were involved in,
yeah.
Was involved in. I mean, one of the things that it did contain was an analysis of the sales data, which showed that London was not fundamentally a global city, but fundamentally the city which was serving British markets. You know, and there were all sorts of issues around that. So it had this global element to it, but it was not the city as such. And I think that connects with the question, what do you mean when you say London this, London that, and London the other? And London is being seen as doing things which are not in the UK interest. Well, which London is it that we're talking about? Some of it, I think, I mean, going back to what Martin is referring to, actually, quite a lot of this is the London demand for property, or the bits of the London economy which are realising property values, I think is one measure of what's taken as being the real economy. But I do think there's a whole series of issues about what is this London economy, and about the real significance of a lot of the studies of this period. You know, it constructed a discourse or rhetoric around this. Actually, I mean, London, as far as I can understand, London did pretty well out of Thatcher, and it did pretty well out of a period in which it didn't have governments. And I think Tony's made this point in the past, that infrastructure came flooding in, not only when there were no great London governments, but actually before people recognised the London World City arguments that were in the UK. So it's part of a momentum that's moving in that direction. So I'm worried about telling too simple a story, which is a kind of ideological story in a sense. You know, the city's done well at times. One of the biggest changes was clearly during the Thatcher era in terms of what happened to earnings in London.
Yeah.
You know, London moved away from the rest of the UK in terms of relative earnings in exactly the Thatcher years, for reasons that had nothing much to do with policy, but to do with deregulation of labour markets and deregulation of product markets and so on. So I'm sure all of that was much more dramatic in its impacts on the city than a lot of what we're talking about.
Well, there's a lot in what you say. Yeah. Go on, good. There's a lot in what you say, and obviously I can't respond to all of it. Let me comment on the things that I can say something about, and you know, maybe Martin would like to say something about, you know, the stature or status of the book itself. In terms of what do I mean by London, I suppose what I'm looking at here is, in a sense, the rhetorical London, the London that speaks to government or speaks to the world through promotional activities, which from 2000 onwards essentially means the GLA and the paraphernalia around it. Before 2000, it means those who purport to speak for London and the sorts of things that they're saying about it. One of the interesting things that's happened a lot in the study, and this picks up on a sort of another theme that you're very interested in, I know, is, you know, I didn't get a chance to say it really very keenly at the end, but almost everybody who thinks about skills, transport, housing, land use issues recognises that actually that, you know, London is a much bigger space than the GLA space, and that one of the problems that you know better than anyone else is that that is not a space that has a voice, and therefore a big problem, if you like, that the regional geography or the regional logic that should be available to London isn't there, and that's very much problematic. Coming to your point about, you know, whether London did better in the Thatcher era before there was either government or governance, the sort of 86 to 90 bit, I suppose the point would be, at least the insights that people have shared with me, is that more or less everybody would say that the deregulations that you spoke of were indeed good for competitiveness, good for attractiveness to international capital, international talent, international firms. But the problem was that they created the incentive, the regulatory framework of openness, low tax, etc., but the infrastructure wasn't there to support it. So if you like, the initial surge of interest in London was then dampened when there wasn't a tube line going to Canary Wharf, or there wasn't an airport that could deal with the capacity, or there wasn't the infrastructure. So if you like, I suppose the comment is, I mean, I'm not going to tell you about business cycles, but the comment is here that those regulatory reforms are seen by many of the people I've interviewed as highly advantageous, but only if coupled with the kinds of governance and investment processes that lead to better infrastructure, lead to higher education that works, lead to a housing supply system that's effective. I don't know whether others want to comment. Maybe Martin does, maybe Tony does. But
I mean, given that you quoted me, I mean, I do think that the report in 1991 crystallised something that has subsequently undoubtedly influenced, changes that have undoubtedly influenced the way, say, the London plan, and indeed lots of other, I'm not saying, I mean, if you look at other big city plans, they all kind of read the same now, and I'm not saying this includes that, but clearly a number of things pointed in the direction of the sort of boosterist view of cities as world cities and as global, and all of the things that the kind of self-image of the people who write them, dare I say it. But I do think that there is a kind of counterfactual worth pursuing, because isn't it, we all know the population of London started to rise in 1985-6, and the long decline of London stopped around, relative economic decline stopped about then. Mm. All of the policies like the Location of Offices Bureau, controls on capital flows and currency fixing the currency, a whole range of regulations were removed by the Thatcher government. And those kind of deregulations, the distaste for planning and all the other things, coupled with the slightly odd invention of the London Docklands Development Corporation and all that went with that, which are in exactly the opposite direction. I think those things do need to be considered. So to ask the question, how much of this wouldn't have happened if the report hadn't been published? I mean, I suppose that's the question to ask. Mm. And I think the other thing that one can't get away from is another intervention by another government, which is Tony Blair's government's accidental, temporary, radical change, possibly long-term radical change to immigration policy, which again changed the way London talked about itself in terms of that long list of people coming from different countries. So I think, you know, there's no doubt the Thatcher government and its deregulation, the Blair government with its significant relaxation of immigration policy did have effects. And I mean, lastly, to look, other things to look at, I mean, the Central London Rail Study in 1989 predates this, and that too, I think, began to capture, because that was done because of the rapid growth of public transport demand after Fair Square and all of that. So there's a kind of link there through to this world as well. So I do think, whilst I still believe that the study is important in crystallising something that was going on, it's not entirely clear whether it's a leading or a lagging indicator.
Very interesting, Tony. I mean, I'm obviously inclined to agree with you, given what I've been saying. But what I think is important, though, is that it is clear that one thing the study did do, and Martin perhaps would chime in, is that it did, as I mentioned in the talk, for the first time it led to a section on London in the manifesto of the winning party in a general election. And what that led to then was a series of conversations between that government and a business elite that was willing to work with them, who then created a set of institutions and an infrastructure to pursue a certain kind of agenda. And I don't believe that, at least if I understood what Martin said to me correctly during our interview, I don't believe that the Conservative Party would have done that in the 92 election if it hadn't been for this study. So I think that's all important bits of the kind of policy history.
I'll just add, actually, that's if I may, that we were fortunate to have Coopers and Lybrand and Lloyd as it then was, now of course merged into PwC, as the lead consultant. And what they brought to it was really an ability, just picking up on Ian Gordon's point, an ability to collate available information. Now Ian's right, the budget did not allow original research to be undertaken, but having but having people of the calibre of leading consultants from Coopers and Lybrand really authoritatively brought to bear the available information and collated it under the various chapter headings in the report to produce something that made people sit up and take notice.
Can I ask a question about the interpretation you put on your study period? I mean, my sense is that you've been analysing and describing very accurately a process in which a particular set of interests really captured the discourse about London. The thing which always amazes me is how narrowly focused that set of interest was. It really was property and real estate world, people, predominantly. Robert Chapman was very well connected in that field, of course. That was her field, that was where she worked. And that's very, very, very effective, that sort of capture of the discourse. Some people got left out, and clearly the poor got left out, people excluded, the labour market got left out, and you talked about that. The group that amazes me, that you didn't refer to, nobody ever refers to, is London employers, if you as it were separate them from their capacity as real estate people. Think of London employers who are not in the real estate or related sectors. In many ways, London employers have done very badly. Have terrible problems recruiting and retaining good staff because of housing costs, and have terrible problems with getting people to work comfortably in a long time. Now, if they're right in the centre of London, then their interests tend to coincide with financial ones and real estate lenders, and they get cross-rise bills, and they'll get a whole load of other major infrastructure investments, which all help to sustain the centre. But in the rest of the city, they don't. And they've never had a good voice, they've never been well organised, they've never got anything. And they and their employees languish in this extremely unsatisfactory and dysfunctional city. I wonder if you have a comment on that.
Gosh, Michael, well, I think that there's something in what you say that resonates with me, and my way of resonating with it is to say, how interesting that in 1991, when this was published, although the London Chamber of Commerce is a partner in the project, it's not the London Chamber of Commerce, which is a more broadly based local thing that takes it forward, but it is more of a business leadership organisation of elite companies that takes the agenda forward. However, that elite group of companies did include British Airways, Diageo, Sainsbury's, Tesco's, and a whole bunch of non-real estates. It's just that it was the headquarters function of those companies, which of course is much more the kind of central elite that you speak about. Of course, the real estate people have to be interested, in a sense, in the whole value chain, and they have to be interested in who their tenants are. So depending upon, you know, what their disposition of land and sites is, they may be more or less sensitive to a broader group of employers. But I think if your point is that the medium-sized employer doesn't have a voice very well in all of this, I think that's utterly right. However, it's anecdotal to say it, but all of the companies I've been interviewing and working with, the ones at the head of the real estate industry, they're all very much concerned about housing costs, skills, inequalities, and everything else. Or at least they are rhetorically, whether they'll do anything about it. So I don't think it's a case of not caring about that agenda. I guess it's a case of how much it matters to them.
Okay, and we have time for one last question.
Well, it's really a comment, Martin. Actually. Yep. Martin Grubstein, I was involved with the Four World Cities, which was in 96.
We should review that in a couple of years' time,
yeah, okay.
Martin.
I was responsible for the Paris chapter of the Four World Cities thing, and I've been working in Paris and in France recently. And it just struck me as interesting, their perception of London, which I've been picking up as I work with municipalities in London, dynamic and exciting, and the capital of Northwest Europe, you know, especially for kids and for 21st century culture. London's a place that gets things done. You know, the tourism industry expanded mainly because of South Bank, which has happened in a way that hasn't happened anywhere in any part of Paris, and Docklands, of course, which they compare very favourably with La Défense, for example. They don't share this whole France that gets everything done very quickly. You know, they haven't finished the Francilien yet, the equivalent of the M25. It takes stuff a long time in contested areas like that. They see London as coping better with diversity challenges, which is an interesting perspective. I think from a city with Tottenham in it, but they really do, compared with their very Islamic dominated inner suburbs. So there's a whole, and then of course they take their regional governance and their high quality transport system rather for granted. So it's just interesting that I think that some of the things that we think are areas that we're worried about still are areas that most other cities would reckon they have considerable difficulty with. I think Paris is in that category.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I spent a couple of days in Paris when I bumped into you there recently and interviewed a whole bunch of people, and they said more or less exactly what you've said, so I won't embellish it. But one of the things that is a bit surprising to me is that, of course, you know, that there's no requirement anyone to be coherent. They're not under examination. So they, in the same paragraph, say to me, on the one hand, you know, we have the Île-de-France, but we wish we had the GLA. We want the metropolitan core to be organised. Then they say, but your GLA has no power. So there's this kind of funny ambiguity between them wanting to have something like, I think something with